Sure. Thanks for the introduction, Hugo, and thank you, Andrea, for an opening presentation that I think identifies some of the broader themes that will be discussed over the coming days. I'm going to do something quite different, actually. So, as I said in my introduction, I'm a journalist based in London. I write for various publications, and the two topics that I have focused on in the last few years are racism and the far right, mainly in Britain but also elsewhere in Europe, and the rights of migrants around Europe, particularly refugees and other irregular migrants. What I want to do today is to focus specifically on a case study from Britain that I think will clarify some of the points that Andrea has made and also maybe provoke some discussion. Perhaps I'd like to try and provoke people to just reconsider things that might be received wisdoms about the nature of far-right movements, the reasons for their growth and emergence, and their decline when that happens. Because I'm a journalist, I'm going to start by stealing another journalist's idea. So apologies to the writer Neil Asherson, who brought this up at a conference earlier this year. But I think it's good to start off with thinking about the origins of the word fascism and the idea of the fasces, the symbol that Mussolini's fascist movement used, that they had taken from ancient Rome, which is this, you know, it's a bundle of sticks bound up by a leather strap that I think Mussolini's fascists used to symbolise kind of, you know, strength through unity. And the thing about using that as a metaphor is essentially those, the individual sticks that are bound up have no inherent relation to one another. They make sense when there's something binding them together, which we can think of as that's what fascism does. It picks up all of these disparate elements and gives them an illusion of coherence and unity and strength. But as soon as that strap is cut, the sticks, you know, they fall and clatter to the ground, and then again, they don't really make much sense together. And I think just to kind of have that idea fixed in our heads over the coming days helps, I think, points to why fascism and far-right politics are particularly complex and difficult to understand at times. And I think I'd like to start by just throwing out a few of these kind of received wisdoms about the far right. My interest as a journalist is really in how these bigger issues play out in everyday life. That's either the everyday political discourse or how they play out among communities directly affected. And it might differ in different countries, but certainly these ideas are current in Britain in the way that the far right and racism and anti-immigration politics are discussed. So the first one that comes up again and again, which is you hear it very often on the left in Britain, is that it's a truism that when economic crisis hits, racism goes up and the far right prospers from that. That's often linked to this idea of competition over scarce resources, so that the roots of far-right politics are in groups of impoverished people turning on one another because there's not enough to go around. Perhaps a more sophisticated, orthodox Marxist sort of interpretation of what fascism is something that Hugo referred to in his introduction, which is this idea that the economic elite uses fascists or fascist measures to maintain profit. Now, I think there's a degree of truth to all of those, but what I want to do now is focus on the specific case of the British National Party to show that perhaps that's not telling the whole, you know, that these ideas don't really give the whole picture. And the British National Party, the BNP, have been active since the early 1980s. They really had their kind of flush of minor electoral success during the first decade of the 2000s. And what I'd like to do now is just, as briefly as I can, kind of run through the backstory of that to just explain their brief success and then spectacular collapse in 2010, and just consider what that tells us about the roots of their support, how that would relate to support for far-right parties in other countries as well, and how that relates to the idea of economic crisis. So the BNP were formed in the early 1980s by a group of people who had profoundly neo-Nazi views, had already had a long history of activism within other neo-Nazi parties in Britain. I would say they were comparable to the ideology of the people that founded Golden Dawn, for example, in that they really looked back to the Third Reich and elements of German Nazism as their guiding light, even if they may have hidden that from public view at times when it was opportune for them to do so. For the first 10 to 20 years of the BNP's existence, it took on a fairly classic form of a fascist movement in that it had an electoral side to what it did and it had a street movement side, so it would hold, you know, provocative marches and rallies. It had groups around it that would actually engage in violent attacks on black people, on leftists, on anti-fascists. And there are numerous cases of BNP members having been discovered to have been stockpiling weapons, stockpiling ingredients for explosives, and in 1999, a former BNP member set off three nail bombs in different areas of London that killed and injured a number of people, and they were targeted at areas of London where there were large ethnic minority populations, and in one case, in Soho, which is London's gay and lesbian district. So that's just to fix the idea of what that, you know, that's where this party originated. And I think if people in the general public in Britain were aware of the BNP up until the late 90s, that's what they would have associated it with. From the end of the 90s onwards, the party made a very marked turn in its strategy under a new leader whose name is Nick Griffin, to seriously pursue electoral politics, to revamp its image and convince people that it had left all of the Nazi-leaning, violent street politics behind, and to, for the first time in its history, seriously try to win elections and enact a strategy for climbing the rungs of power, starting at the lowest level of politics but working its way up. Now, that wasn't by any means a completely new development in on their part in Britain. What the BNP were doing, most of all, was looking across the Channel to France, to the way in which Jean-Marie Le Pen had managed to do something similar with the Front National. And the Front National's theories about how you not only had to campaign on political issues, but you had to build a movement that pushed for and they use this term, even though it's something that's more traditionally associated with the left, push for cultural hegemony, make sure you're, you know, keep pushing your ideas, find ways to build social movements so that, you know, you're twisting the whole political debate around to terms that suit the particular issues that you want to then push forwards. At the kind of other end of it, the way in which the BNP decided it would try and put this into practice was it developed this theory of what it called community politics. So it would home in on very, very localised issues and grievances and try and enter a fairly small local community. So this is on the level of a council district or a city neighbourhood or a small town. And find a local grievance, position itself as the voice of that grievance against a political elite, a local political establishment that were perceived to not be listening to its own voters, and to win votes that way, and to tie whatever those local grievances were to its broader, profoundly racist message, which, you know, came down to this idea that you know, white people were becoming a kind of oppressed majority in their own country, that immigration was destroying national culture, and that, you know, national and international politics were run by an unaccountable, corrupt and conspiratorial elite. And I think you can see in that last phrase, for example, that more established neo-Nazi ideas about of anti-Semitic conspiracy theory and the rest were still present in the ideas that drove the BNP. It's just that the way that they would phrase those when encountering the public would have all of that kind of removed, or at least hidden beneath the surface. This strategy had unprecedented success for a far-right party in Britain. So from the early 2000s onward, the BNP started to win increasing numbers of seats on local councils, almost entirely in England, which is to do with the specifics of the, Britain and the tensions between the different nations that make up Britain. But its peak came in 2009 when it had two candidates elected to the European Parliament and received, I think, around 950,000 votes, which I think is the highest vote ever for a far-right party in Britain, or at least it's certainly one of. However, but a year later, in 2010, in the British general election, the party had promised much to its supporters, had threatened that it was going to win lots more council seats because there were local elections happening at the same time as the national parliamentary elections, and that it was even presenting a serious challenge for seats in the national parliament in certain areas. This was not borne out. The party sort of massively overstretched, and failed to even meet its kind of minimum promises, which then led to infighting, lots of voters deserting it, and the eventual collapse of the party. So now the BNP still exists in name, but the vast majority of its supporters have drifted elsewhere. Its membership has left, and parts of its membership have split off and formed various splinter groups. So it's now in, you know, it's very, very far on the margins of British politics. I think for today's discussion, the crucial point to take hold of really is that the BNP's electoral success happened broadly between 2001 and even by 2009, at a local level, it already peaked. So really, between 2001 and 2008 is when it was picking up most of its votes. Now, I mean, probably people can already spot that's before the financial crash and the economic crisis and the austerity measures that were put in place to deal with that. So I think that immediately suggests, well, hang on, so what else is going on then, if this is clearly not an instrumental, doesn't have an instrumental relationship to crash and recession and austerity, if this party was already emerging as a movement, you know, before 2008. I just want to make two points related to that can then perhaps be discussed further after I finish my presentation, which is one, perhaps looking just at the idea of economic crisis is not enough. I would say the BNP were benefiting from a crisis, but it was primarily a crisis of legitimacy. So it was, you know, a growing phenomenon in Britain, which I think has been shared in other European countries, that there are increasing numbers of people were feeling that mainstream political parties didn't speak for them, ignored them, didn't have their interests at heart, didn't differ significantly between each other in terms of policies and ideology. And from 2001 onwards in Britain, you've had this phenomenon of falling turnouts at elections. Opinion polls and other studies of public attitudes towards national politics have shown a growing number of people feeling that it's often termed apathy, but I think that mischaracterizes it, because it's not that people don't care about politics, it's that they're saying we perceive that what is presented to us as politics just, you know, there's nothing at stake there. There's nothing. We don't have a stake in it, because these politicians are all acting in what we see as a different set of interests to our own. And I think it's really important to recognise that while that is very much discussed now in Britain and I think other European countries in the context of austerity, it's something that was well underway before the crash and the responses to the crash. Perhaps other people here will want to sort of explore the reasons why that might not be. I mean, I just, you know, my kind of crude, non-expert interpretation of that is that that's a result of, certainly in Britain, all of the mainstream parties accepting neoliberal ideology as the foundations of their, you know, their policy making, and that contributing to the process of the hollowing out of those main political parties. It's a phenomenon that's particularly affected the left and voters traditionally associated with the left. So the Labour Party, which was in government from 1997 until 2010, lost 5 million voters during that period. 4 million of them came from working class backgrounds, i.e. from the Labour Party's traditional base. But you've also seen this phenomenon happening with traditional Conservative Party voters as well. And the second point I wanted to make in relation to that is, well, perhaps this is evidence of what we might call a crisis before the crisis. So the British National Party's strategy was always that it would try and combine a disgruntled middle and lower middle class, largely rural voting base that you might consider a traditional Conservative vote with a disaffected, aggrieved, white, working class, urban vote. And it would sort of unite these two, what it perceived as the sort of the two halves of, you know, authentic white Britain into a movement that would, you know, re-establish British national sovereignty in relation to Europe, would wrest control of British culture and society and politics from what it perceived to be as a corrupt, impure liberal elite that was encouraging immigration and prized the rights of ethnic minorities over the rights of what they would call indigenous white Britons. But the first part of that strategy didn't work. It never managed to win over significant numbers of former Conservative Party voters. Where it did make inroads was in particular largely working class communities around England. So in certain outer suburbs of London, in certain towns in the northwest of England that had been former, you know, very strong industrial areas where a key industry had declined and there was, for various reasons, widespread disaffection with the local political establishment. And I sit on the fence about this a bit, to be honest. I think the sort of the driving factor in what gave the BNP the successes it had were these really specific local grievances. So it would be an idea that the local council was not allocating housing fairly, or that the local council had merely or simply just sort of abandoned a town and let buildings fall derelict and wasn't really, you know, they couldn't really see any investment or any changes to their immediate environment. And then there would often be an added element of recent or rapid ethnic change, which the BNP could very easily link to the decline and perceived neglect of a town. But in the background, you know, this was superficially a boom period for Britain. So this was during, you know, the new Labour government when they were, you know, delivering what looked like record economic growth, big sort of, you know, investment in the regeneration of major urban centres. But from 2001 onwards, wages in real terms for the bottom half of earners started to stagnate, and I think from 2004 onwards, those wages started to decline. So there were, even during the period of economic growth, there was a section of the British population that were losing out from that and could feel it, I think. And I think, you know, my approach as a journalist to this subject is to go out and interview people and see how it, you know, how they fit these bigger issues into their lives. So a lot of the, you know, the material that I gather is anecdotal or narrative, or it's people talking about, you know, how they feel about how their lives are changing. And these are things that would come up again and again in the interviews. People would link a local grievance with what they saw as something bigger and more national, which was a sense that, you know, they were working twice as hard for half the money. They could see other people doing better than them, you know, people getting bigger houses, and they weren't, you know, they were working hard, and there were people that they would perceive around them, or that they would see on TV or read about in the newspapers, who were getting a free ride, who weren't, you know, who weren't playing fairly, or were being given advantages that they weren't. And all of that, it's kind of a, you know, in Britain certainly, this is a kind of toxic background noise that is whipped up by the tabloid press again and again, and it's only, you know, since 2009 that's just gone into overdrive, but it was very, very much there before, and that really was the sort of, I don't know, it was the sort of fertilizer that was spread over the ground where the BNP were active and were able to kind of grow their support. Just to conclude, I also want to just now make another suggestion that people should have in their minds over the coming few days, which is, I'd say broadly I agree with Andrea, actually. I don't think there's any realistic prospect of a far-right party taking over in Europe. Even in France, I don't think that will happen. Even in Greece, where Golden Dawn is clearly the sort of most acute and pressing threat from a kind of classic violent neo-Nazi, your sort of militaristic movement, I don't think they're in any real prospect of taking power and governing the country. Others might disagree. It's certainly a valid topic for debate, but I think if you only stick on that question, you miss what is already happening, which is the relationship between extremist parties and the centre, in that extremist parties do not need to govern to start having things move in the way that they want things to move. And again, the BNP in Britain are a very good case of this. So they collapsed in 2010, but that by no means suggests that any of those wider factors or any of the grievances that they were playing on and playing up have gone away. In fact, what's happened is it's just, you know, it's grown exponentially because another party has come along that's been much more successful at mobilising those grievances, which is the UK Independence Party. And one of the reasons that it's been more successful is that it's racist, it's hard right, it's populist, but it isn't fascist. And that goes back to this idea that the economic elite want to use fascist parties. I think by and large they don't, because fascist parties are unreliable. They very often behave eccentrically and unpredictably. They do things like, they murder people in broad daylight, and that causes a massive backlash against people that might have been sympathetic to them, for example. But what they can do, and what the BNP certainly did, was play a really crucial role as a kind of outrider in making views that were previously held to be unacceptable in the normal terms of political debate acceptable. And I think, you know, there are lots and lots of examples of this. I think a really good revealing one that's got particular relevance at the moment is that in 2009, when the BNP's leader Nick Griffin was one of the two candidates elected to the European Parliament, his first week in the European Parliament, he made headlines back in Britain with what was perceived to be a gaffe, you know, a verbal slip, you know, an error that he made, you know, a terrible mistake, this will undermine his own support. And it was because he said that the EU should sink boats carrying migrants across the Mediterranean from North Africa to Europe. This was regarded as completely outrageous, unacceptable, and, you know, who could say such a thing? About a month ago, in a written answer to a parliamentary question in the House of Lords, it was revealed that the current British government's position on boat rescues in the Mediterranean is that it's not funding the EU search and rescue operation because, you know, it phrased it in more polite words, but essentially it thinks that if boats sink, then that will act as a deterrent to other migrants who might otherwise have tried to cross. I think that's a very clear example of when, you know, in the space of 5 years, an idea that was regarded as completely beyond the pale has now, you know, it's there at the heart of mainstream policy. I'm going to conclude there. I should also just make one brief final note that the BNP did not collapse on its own. It was as a result of a very strong grassroots anti-fascist movement in Britain that draws on a long tradition and history of those kind of movements, of challenging fascism and being able to, you know, I think Britain's not so good at challenging racist politics. The way in which mainstream politicians are now responding to the UK Independence Party's presence, for example, shows that. But I think one thing that British grassroots politics has got right again and again is being able to kind of draw this line and say, well, no, you know, whatever else, things that fall into that category of fascist or far right or neo-Nazi are just, you know, we're gonna hold the line there and push back against it and say no. And I think that's also another thing that should be noted and perhaps discussed. Thanks.